and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast in which Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts delve into the big issues in international affairs. My name is Roland Raja and I'm the lead economist at the Lowy Institute. Today I'm sitting down to talk with Dr. John Edwards, who's just released a new Lowy Institute paper entitled Reconstruction, Australia After COVID. John Edwards is a senior fellow with the Lowy Institute and an adjunct professor at Curtin University. Among many things, he was previously a member of the board of the Reserve Bank of Australia and a senior economic advisor to former Prime Minister Paul Keating. We are also joined today by Jennifer Hewitt. Jennifer is a national affairs columnist at the Australian Financial Review and is one of Australia's leading commentators on politics, business, and the economy. John and Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks. Pleasure to join the conversation.
John, let's start with you. In your book, you say that Australia has done quite well through COVID, and I think most people would agree if you look at things internationally. But let me ask you just to kick things off, you know, why do you say that Australia has done well? You know, were you surprised by that? And you know, what do you sort of attribute that our success so far to precisely?
Well, I think I am surprised that we've done quite as well as we have had. I mean, I was optimistic, but we've done better than even my most optimistic expectations. On the health side, I think we've done well because it turns out we're a more compliant country than we expected. We're more willing to follow government instruction. It's a remarkable thing, for example, that we can be told, well, you're not allowed to leave the country, or if you're out of the country, you're not allowed to come back. Or if you have to come back, if you're given permission to come back, you've got to hole up in a hotel and pay for the enjoyment of it. Well, this was not considered part of the Australian character, but we've gone along, we've been compliant, we followed the social distancing rules, and accordingly, we restricted the virulence of the epidemic. On the economic side, we've come out of it much sooner than I expected and in better condition than I expected. Employment, for example, in February 2021 matched employment in February 2020, which is a bit sooner than I expected. And we're talking in March. I think it's likely for the quarter just ending that output's never been higher. On Reserve Bank figures, household wealth's never been higher than it is today. Well, I think a lot of that is probably due to the rapidity and size of the response of fiscal policy, that is Treasury and the Treasurer and the National Cabinet, and of the Reserve Bank of Australia, both responding with very, very big changes of policy, far bigger than were implemented in the case of the 2008 financial crisis, which was subsequently considered excessive, but has been made to appear quite small by contrast.
Thanks, John. Jennifer, I'll bring you in. I mean, what's your response to some of John's arguments in terms of that success? You know, and many would also say that, you know, one of the flip sides of the success has perhaps been that, you know, politicians, the public, even the business community has become perhaps risk averse or even complacent. I mean, do you think that has been the case? Do you think we've been successful, but do you think that at some level we've also, you know, been a victim perhaps of our own success?
Well, yes, look, I think in some ways we are showing that. If you look at a year ago, obviously, as John says, you know, the situation is far better than we dared hope, really, in terms of the economy and in terms of health outcomes. Obviously, there were some grievous errors in terms of government policy, particularly state government policy, most noticeably in Victoria. But in general, I think the federal government was able to close the borders a little late, but was still got away with that. And to John's point, I think, yes, Australians are extremely compliant. We always look to government, and particularly in terms of crisis, for direction. And if it is clear enough, then people are more than willing to go along. And in this case, I think the unknown was so alarming for people that they were certainly willing to, you know, follow directions and then, of course, to see the results. So I think the good results. So I think that really helped. So we now come out, you know, a year later to have, yes, an economy that is operating much better, a health outcome that is much better, despite, you know, the still occasional outbreaks as we're seeing at the moment in Queensland. But the only catch with this is that during the time, certainly the Morrison government, Treasury, the RBA, and much of business operated and were able to change direction. Pivot became, you know, the fashionable world, the word of 2020, and to really accommodate all the new demands on them. And you saw that, you know, very, very clearly with a program like JobKeeper, for example. But now, I think the momentum in some ways has slowed dramatically, and we're back to that idea of very piecemeal, incremental changes. The fact that we can now talk about, you know, getting back to much where we were pre-pandemic at the moment is good, obviously, in many ways. But it's certainly, I think, the appetite for risk and taking unnecessary risk has diminished, certainly in terms of the population's attitude towards the idea of living with the virus, and also in terms of the government's attitude to try and make the type of sweeping reforms that they talked about initially and reset the economy. That's gone too, and business is just, I think, happy to be back and profitable.
John, I mean, what do you think of this? I mean, do you think that, you know, the flip side of Australia's COVID success is that there is some degree of complacency? You know, Jennifer says that perhaps, you know, we need to be thinking about doing more, particularly in terms of economic reform. I mean, what's your view?
It depends on the reform, I think. You know, quite what do we have in mind that we need to do that we think is going to make a difference? I think there are things we can do in education, things we can do in the integration of our state health systems. There are things we can do in infrastructure, lots of things we can do in energy and in the transition to green energy. By and large, we're doing most of these things. I'm not quite sure where the big omission is. I'd like to know more, you know, if people have got good ideas, what they are exactly.
Jennifer, do you want to throw in here with what would you like to see if in terms of more ambition?
Well, John, of course, is quite correct. There's always this, you know, idea that Australia needs more reform, and yet, as he points out in his book, we seem to, you know, muddle along incredibly successfully as an economy and a country. I think, to John's point, you know, the idea of education, of infrastructure, I would add, you know, some of the changes to the tax system. We clearly just had a breakdown of any suggestion that we could make our economy more efficient by having industrial relations reform. That's kind of gone by the by now. But, and we seem also in terms of energy, again, we may be getting there by default. That is right. I mean, I think you see a lot of businesses taking on the changes that are, you know, sweeping across the world in terms of the change to renewable energy. Kind of in many ways, despite the lack of coordination or between state and federal governments, for example. So, but I think it's more this idea that we don't quite know where we're going. Now, maybe that's right, as John says, you know, that doesn't matter, and as we know, expert predictions kind of have a habit of being wrong anyway, and forecasts do always get it wrong. But I think we're going to just continue along the path that we have had. And pre-COVID, many people would say that was not sufficient. You'll have Philip Lowe, John disagrees with this, saying that business investment in productive change, low productivity, business investment is too low, and and that we had too sluggish an economy before in terms of getting real wages up and unemployment down far enough, but mainly real wages up. And I think we're going back to that world. Maybe there's no alternative, but I don't think that the ambition to change that radically seems to have disappeared.
And John, of course, this is one of the key themes in your book. I mean, you argue that Australia has not only done well in managing COVID, but actually the pre-COVID economy was, you know, pretty good and better than what a lot of commentators would have said, you know, which were more, those views were more critical. So can you elaborate a little bit here on in. What do you think of the pre-COVID economy? And if we're heading back to that, should Australians look at that and think that's pretty good as a starting point?
Well, we can't head back to it. You know, it's in the past. What kind of economy in terms of productivity, investment and so forth will now be presented with? I'm not sure. It's not going to be the old one. But I would say of the old one that it had many merits. It had the merit that in volume terms, non-mining business investment was at record levels. It had the merit that employment had increased more rapidly in the 5 years to 2019 than it had prior to that, and matched the record of the 5 years to 2008. We had very serious increase in household wealth. We had a slowdown in growth, that's true, but we'd had a slowdown in growth through the entire 21st century thus far. And other countries shared this slowdown, other advanced economies, because principally we were not getting the kind of productivity growth we got in the 90s. Well, this is a problem we share with most advanced economies. There's a lot of controversy over the causes of it. What I do think is that I don't see an industrial relations change as being a solution. I think there are all kinds of things we should be doing in industrial relations that would enhance our performance, but there's nothing we can do in industrial relations that's going to dramatically change it. And we know that because in the 20 years to 2019, we had three or four different industrial relations regimes, all of which were consistent with declining productivity growth. The most notable one being the decline in productivity growth during work choices.
Yeah, sticking with the labour market then, I mean, a big theme in your book is that one of the key things, almost the key thing that we're going to need to focus on coming out of the pandemic is getting unemployment down. And you talk a lot about the different roles that fiscal and monetary policy are going to need to play going forward, how they're going to need to work together and how that's going to need to be different to what we're used to for quite some time in the past, in the pre-COVID. Can you share with us a little bit? I mean, what's the unemployment situation looking like coming out of the pandemic? Where do you think things are headed? And what is the government and indeed the Reserve Bank going to need to do in order to get things right?
Well, we saw in February that the number of jobs was back to where it was in the previous February. So that's good. And the number of full-time jobs was back to where it was in February. So that's also good. But unemployment was more than 100,000 higher. So that's a gap we've got to fill. We now want to get to 4.5% unemployment rather than 5.2%, which is what we had going into the pandemic. So that's another 100,000 jobs, so 200,000 already. And then we're told that maybe 100,000 people or more are going to lose their jobs with the end of JobKeeper, which ended last week. So that's 300,000. We're 300,000 jobs short, you might say, coming out of the pandemic. If we're going to achieve our goal, we're not going to achieve it immediately. We've got a chance of achieving it over, say, 5 years, but only if we can sustain a quite reasonable rate of growth of economic output. And we have to face the fact that the Reserve Bank of Australia has exhausted its means of stimulating the economy. It's not to say that monetary policy won't continue to be effective in supporting growth, but there's not much you can do to make it grow faster. That interest rates are already at rock bottom. It's already intervening substantially in the bond market to suppress the rise of bond rates and to suppress the increase in the Australian dollar. So the Reserve Bank is going flat out, but there's not much more it can do. And that means the other arm of policy, fiscal policy, is going to be more important. In the decade to 2019, fiscal policy was mostly contractionary, almost every year, except with one exception, and that was mainly due to timing fiddles. Mostly contractionary, following a theme that we needed to restore the budget to balance as soon as we could. Well, we just can't continue with that and also achieve our new target of 4.5% unemployment. It's certainly the case that there has to be a contraction in the deficit between this financial year and next as we wind down the biggest of the programs, JobKeeper. But that'll be offset to some extent by very high household balances. It looks like household bank deposits, for example, are at least $100 billion higher than they would otherwise be as a result of being unable to spend money, as a result of programs like JobKeeper, and perhaps some precautionary saving. So that's a bit of an offset. Whether it's enough of an offset, we'll discover in the course of next year. If it's not enough of an offset, then, you know, I think there's room for fiscal policy to be more agile, to be varied more frequently, to move away from, you know, an annual casting of fiscal policy towards a more rapid response to changes in demand. And I think that seems to be the mood in Treasury. Whether the Morrison government feels the same way, we'll soon discover.
Jennifer, I mean, what are your views on this? I mean, obviously the politics of debt and deficits has changed, you know, but there's one thing to do with the depth of the pandemic and the need for things like JobKeeper, and another thing in terms of what John's talking about now, which is a need to switch towards a much more activist fiscal policy, certainly at least over the medium, if not longer term as well. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's been fascinating how, you know, we've switched so completely from the talk of reducing the budget and getting to budget surplus, you know, as the one of the most important things that any government could do, and of course one of the proudest boasts of the coalition government, to suddenly having the public kind of have to conceive the idea that budgets and deficits and surpluses were, you know, that they've gone for the foreseeable future, and that it's that government spending is a good thing. So I think this is still a kind of, frankly, a work in progress. And I do think what the last year has demonstrated is that the Morrison government and Treasurer Josh Frydenberg will be very happy to follow Treasury's advice if they think there's more fiscal stimulus needed. That's not to say that they would embrace, you know, the same type of big spending program. But if there was suddenly another crisis, I think they would. I'm really kind of much more optimistic about how flexible the government's prepared to be. And of course, the other issue this year is that, to John's point, they will be wanting to show responsibility, you know, in terms of spending. So I don't think this budget, the May budget, will be a particularly big spending one, certainly not like it was, you know, last October. But neither will they want to, you know, run any risk of the economy going backwards or not continuing to recover in the way that it has. So to John's point, I think they will be continually looking, revising, adjusting, and working very closely. Although monetary policy has been exhausted, as John points out, they're still obviously working very, very closely with the Reserve Bank, try and make sure that as much as possible things kind of complement one another.
And Jennifer, do you think, you know, politically, of course, there's been a big, you know, 180 degree turn for the coalition, and that's been driven by circumstance. And as you say, they're going to probably be more flexible going forward and not wanting to undermine recovery. Do you think politics is still going to get in the way? I mean, how much trouble do you think it's going to be for the coalition, given, you know, traditionally, at least, many coalition supporters do put more emphasis on keeping the size of government debt more contained and over the medium term, the budget in balance. Do you think that's still going to be a problem to some degree that they are going to have to actively manage?
Well, they're certainly not going to get any criticism really from Labor, are they, in terms of not spending enough? So that's going to kind of protect them in that side. So and in terms of managing their own internal politics, there'll be a bit of concern, you know. But really, the Morrison government is, in that sense, you know, quite moderate, quite middle of the road. They're prepared to do whatever it takes. They don't have any strong kind of ideological position in practice. And they would also be deeply aware in terms of politics that the public, having always tended to give more credit, I think, to the ability of a coalition government to manage the economy well, have now had to adjust to the idea that, you know, a coalition government will also say, oh, yes, we can spend up and spend up big. So I think it's kind of dangerous politics for the coalition to suddenly kind of, and they would know it, to suddenly say that austerity, for example, you know, is really something that should be followed. So I think you'll just kind of get this emphasis on doing the responsible thing, and that will be defined whatever the circumstances of the moment seem to be.
And John, moving away a little bit from the politics, then focusing more on the economics. I mean, you've talked already about the need to get unemployment down, and that's the central sort of policy challenge. But you know, there are a lot of other things that, you know, economists typically worry about. We're worrying less about debt these days, but there's a number, and we're worrying less about inflation, although some of the concerns around inflation are starting to come back. You know, certainly in Australia, there's a lot of concern around housing prices and where these things are going. So aside from unemployment, I mean, what do you think are the big sort of macroeconomic risks?
Well, I think debt is not a problem we should overestimate. Interest rates are so extraordinarily low, particularly bond rates, that even if they come up a bit, interest rate will be comfortably below the rate of growth of nominal GDP, and accordingly, any existing level of debt will decline as a share of GDP. So as, you know, some economists remark, the debt burden on the next generation will actually be less than the debt burden on this generation, despite the amount of spending. It's already the case, remarkably, that Commonwealth is paying, as a share of GDP, is paying less today on its very greatly expanded debt than it paid, say, in 2015 on a very much diminished debt. That's the power of the change in the bond rate. So I'm less worried about debt, although it's something we need to, you know, monitor closely. I'm not too worried about inflation. I think if there was a direct connection between change in the money supply and inflation, then we would have seen hyperinflation in Japan 20 years ago. But in fact, Japan has not succeeded in getting its inflation rate up, which was the intention of policy. And similarly, we would have seen it in the US from 2008, when there was a huge expansion in the money supply, and in fact, inflation's come down. So I'm less concerned about that. I think it's, you know, we'll see inflation if global demand outruns global supply, but we're very, very far from that condition. So I'm really concerned about the thing that most concerns Jennifer, I think, that is productivity, getting our productivity growth up. I'm not really convinced that the way to getting it up lies through industrial relations changes. You know, I think we've got a reasonably open system already, reasonably flexible system already. I'm not sure it lies through tax changes of the kind that, you know, could plausibly be affected. I think we can do more on infrastructure. There are certain things we can do, for example, in the area of health, which is a very big spending area. We certainly ought to be, you know, as attentive as we can to enhancing our human capital, because it's a services economy after all, and there's a direct relationship between the quality of our human capital and the capacity to increase output. But otherwise, I'm uncertain of the prospects for higher productivity growth. You know, it's not necessarily within under our foot. But it's a big issue facing us. Unless we can get productivity growth up, we're limited to the rate of growth of our workforce. That will sustain us for a few years, and then we're going to hit a wall again.
Jennifer, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, and one other interesting point that I think that Phil Lowe is always on about, and this is the idea of getting real wages growth up. And which, of course, is, again, not confined to Australia. That hasn't happened. He believes very firmly that if you get unemployment down sufficiently, nobody knows exactly where, but, you know, maybe even below 4%, but certainly at least around the 4%, then that will automatically flow through to wage increases. Whether or not that happens, you know, is going to be one of the very interesting kind of questions for the next few years, because despite that kind of optimism that that will happen, it's so far been proven very kind of resistant to that idea. So I just think that's going to be something to watch in the next couple of years. Mind you, that's a good problem to have, of course, because it does mean that you will get, that does mean. I'm probably slightly more optimistic than John is. I'm not quite sure why, because John's always very optimistic, but about the ability to get unemployment down quicker than we expect. And I think you've seen that again over the last several months.
We're moving towards the late part of our discussion. So I want to think a little bit more on the international issues here. And a few things, John, just to go to you first. Globalization, immigration, what's your assessment of the situation? You know, and what are we going to need in order to manage things going forward and secure Australia's ongoing prosperity?
Well, on globalization, I think that on the evidence so far, globalization has been affirmed by the experience of the pandemic. It was a common problem to all countries. We went about dealing with it in much the same way, both from a health aspect and an economic aspect. And we had similar experiences. Surprisingly, there was no serious increase in trade barriers during the pandemic. There were very few disputes notified to the World Trade Organization. And we learnt that in January, the volume of world trade had not only returned to what it was before, but had well exceeded it, that world trade had reached a new record high. So all that seems to me to suggest globalization was affirmed. I think that's also evident in fact that the US and China have not decoupled, or China hasn't decoupled from the rest of the world. On the contrary, China seems to be more engaged in the rest of the world. US exports to China rose quite considerably over the course of 2020, and total of foreign investment into China from other countries rose so strongly that it displaced the US as the primary destination for foreign investment over the course of 2020. On immigration, we're not going to see immigration returning to anything like the numbers we had before. We had a net of around about 300,000 in 2018, 2019. In net terms, it's down 100,000 in 2020, and it's not going to come back for a while because we're not going to open our borders for a while. But I think if we have to take a hit on migration, now's a good time to take it, because we have an unemployment problem. It's not useful, I think, to have a big immigration program running while you've got a big unemployment problem. Because you're inviting people into an economy which is already stressed on employment levels. So I'm confident the immigration program will resume in a few years and we'll benefit from it. And now it's not a bad time to see reduced migration, I think.
Jennifer, do you want to come in on any of those points, but otherwise also the relationship with China, obviously a big part of the Australian economic story, but things have gone sour recently. So, you know, what are your views there on how, in terms of how that's been managed?
Just briefly, in terms of the immigration issue, I completely agree with John that it is a good time to at least pause the kind of mass immigration that we've had in Australia. And if anything, you know, allow things like infrastructure to catch up. But I'm actually doubtful that we will go back to the types of levels of immigration that we had previously for some time, if ever. And I think that will be a popular move. And so I think it'll be kind of dangerous for a government to kind of try and ramp it up very fast or to a huge level again, just because of the way that Australia lives and the size of the cities and things like that. So that's a kind of a complicated issue, but that'll play out again in a few years' time. In terms of China, this has been, again, building over this problem. Political problems with China have been building over years, actually. For at least 4 years, we haven't been able to have any high-level ministerial kind of contact with China. They were very irritated with Malcolm Turnbull, the Turnbull government, and that's been totally exacerbated in the last several months. And because of their complaints about Australia and because of China's also, you know, approach to the world and its demonstration, wanting to demonstrate that there is a cost to criticising China, this is going to be a huge issue for Australia to manage. And it's hidden in a sense because they have no alternative at the moment and probably for some years at least to our iron ore, our biggest export. So that obscures the really big issues that are going on. And although we kind of tend to obsess and look inwards, of course, when we look at a lot of these kind of domestic issues, the geopolitical kind of atmosphere around or region around Australia is far more dangerous than I can recall. And it's going to take, you know, as John points out constantly in his book, it will take, you know, careful management. Well, it certainly will. And many of those, that management, though, will be of events that really are beyond our control.
John, I'll give the last word to you just on the China question. How are you seeing things?
Well, I agree with everything that Jennifer says. It's a big problem. It does need to be carefully managed. It's got a lot worse over the last 5 years or more. And it's been a while, as she said, since we've had high-level contact. It's not quite as bad as it could be in the sense that China's actions against barley, wine, to some extent about on coal, although it's not clear quite where China's going on coal. But if it's barley, wine, lobsters, it's basically a symbolic gesture, one that, you know, we should interpret correctly. It makes no, you know, substantial difference to our overall trade. And China, fortunately, at least in the case of barley and wine, is following WTO procedures, which is a good thing. We ourselves follow WTO procedures in our anti-dumping actions against Chinese exports, which are vastly more extensive than its anti-dumping actions against us. So we shouldn't be entirely dismayed by the state of our China-Australia relations, but I think they need careful management. We don't have room for mistakes and we don't have room for gestures that injure the relationship without any offsetting benefit.
Thanks for that, John. We might have to wrap things up there. Let me thank both of you, John and Jennifer, for sharing your insights with me and our listeners. You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute hosted by Institute experts with production assistance from Jennifer Reinhart. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to you joining us for the next episode of Lowy Institute Conversations.